Bloomberg Surveillance.
We've got crisis fatigue with this Euro-Greek crisis this time around. It's playing as a Euro-Greek equity market story rather than a global risk dynamic.
Because we know the labor market's doing well, then we know pretty much everything else is doing okay.
I think you're going to see earnings estimates come up second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. I think the consensus is still too low.
Bloomberg Surveillance, your link to the world of economics, finance, and investment on Bloomberg Radio.
Good morning, everybody. It is 8 o'clock on Wall Street. Well, now they're talking publicly about Grexit. Conversations with Dijsselbloem, the head of the finance ministers group in Europe, and Tsipras, the prime minister of Greece. Tsipras says his government this morning, he said his government is willing to say the big no. He's willing to take responsibility for refusing a deal if necessary. Alfred E. Newman rules the markets. What? Me? Worry? Bond yields. Even with what's going on, bond yields fall in Europe, rise in the U.S. Oh, and don't forget, Janet Yellen and the Feds on stage this afternoon. We're going to be the warm-up act here on Surveillance. I'm Michael McKee along with Tom Keene. And as I mentioned, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of concern in financial markets. European equities are down at the moment. The FTSE off by 34, the DAX by 80.7 tenths of a percent. CAC 40 in Paris really taking a beating today, 1.2% decline, 58 points. But you look at bond yields over in Europe, German Bunds, the twos are still negative at point minus 0.003. 10-year at minus 0.06. That's the change, rather. The yield is at 0.79% on the day. The French oats are down. The BTPs in Italy are down. A Spanish 10-year note yield at 2.31 is off by 4 basis points. Same story here in the United States. S&P E-mini futures are up a point at the moment. Dow E-mini futures are up a tenth of a percent, 19 points. NASDAQ E-mini futures essentially unchanged on the day. 10-year note yield 2.33%, 2 basis points higher. 2 basis points higher is the 5-year at 1.6799, call it 1.68, and 0.70 for your 2-year note yield, up 2 basis points. The euro, 112.72, is higher by 0.2 of a percent. Yen, a little bit higher as well, 123.88. So it doesn't look like there's a huge amount of concern racing around the world at the moment. David Wu is the head of global rates and currencies research at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Euro stronger, European yields lower. Markets aren't worried about Greek contagion, at least not at the moment. Are you?
I am. I mean, because I think, you know, the reason why I am is because I think the market is only focusing on two scenarios where I think there's a third scenario that's even more important and much more plausible. The market thinks either they're going to come to an agreement or they won't come to agreement. And then if they don't come to agreement, Greece is going to exit, which is not bad for Europe either. But I think the third scenario, which is a protracted divorce that gets really, really messy, including the possibility of basically default but no exit and capital controls, which could actually drag on this conflict much lower. I think that's probably by far the worst basically outcome from this confrontation, and I think that will be the scenario that will be associated with the most lower euro.
The worst possible scenario, capital controls, that would work for Cyprus. Cyprus is in much better shape today.
Yeah, exactly, especially given the fact that Greece is running a primary surplus on the fiscal front, and they're running a small current account surplus. So from that point of view, even the Greek banks would default on their ECB, basically, loans. I don't think from that point of view that they could – I think they could actually very well basically keep it going for at least a few months. So I think, you know, that as a bargaining essentially – you know, that could be a bargaining position that actually might even improve for Greece if they were to go down that path, stop basically paying. Because if the Greeks – if the Germans not getting even a dime back, they might decide to basically, you know, renegotiate to get some money basically back. So I think from that point of view, that is a very dangerous, I think, you know, and precarious situation that the market is definitely ignoring at the moment.
Interesting survey by Bank of America Merrill Lynch over in Europe of money managers, finding that the amount of cash in portfolios rose to 4.9% in June, the highest level since January, a 6-year high for European fund managers. So maybe it's not that they're doing a flight to safety. They're just putting the money under the mattress at the moment.
I think that's certainly true in Europe, but so far according to our own proprietary equity data, U.S. investors, ironically, remain very long and overweight European equities. And I think, you know, this is why, you know, I think, you know, in some sense, there's a certain asymmetry across the Atlantic about how the market is positioned. And this is another reason why I think volatility is not fully pricing in the potential outcome.
David Wu with us with Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Good morning, everyone. Bloomberg Surveillance brought to you by Cohn Resnick Accounting Tax Advisory. Cohn Resnick will provide your business with the industry insight it needs to succeed in a dynamic economy. Sign up for insights and find out how at CohnResnick.com, CohnResnick, CohnResnick.com. David, let's triangulate the calm in the markets, as Mike McKee mentions, but the enhanced volatility seen, particularly in euro, and the worries about a lack of liquidity in the very short-term paper market. How do you bring those three moving parts together?
I think, you know, it's interesting because volatility, actually, if you look at actually the volatility surface, right now the volatility for example, something like euro is highly inverted. The market is now pricing very high volatility for the next basically month or two.
Right.
And the volatility sort of comes off very, very quickly as we go into the summer months. So the market thinks that, yeah, this is going to be a credit event, but it's not going to last for very long. This is why everybody's so relaxed about it. People think that this is going to be a relatively short event. And I think that's consistent with how all other markets are behaving. I personally think, therefore, the pain trade is that it just turns out to be a very long, drawn-out, messy, basically, separation that's going to keep the market on its toes for the basically 3 months of the summer. That's what makes market, without my making the market very nervous.
What will that do to equity markets, and what will that do to the euro if you get the pain trade?
I think you get a pain trade. I think European equities probably have more downside. There's no question about that, right? You know, European equity is still the best performing, I think, from the point of view, certainly on the currency, you know, basically a hedge basis. And moreover, we still think that, you know, investors are probably more overweight European equities than perhaps any other market. So I think from that point of view, a long drawn out, especially given we're still not seeing any improvement on the earnings front as far as Europe is concerned. So the market is already building a lot of goodwill based on QE alone. But I think that argument is going to start to sound hollow if this whole Greek situation were to drag out even longer.
How correlated are equity markets around the world? How much are U.S. equities going to respond to what's going on in the fallout from Europe? And I'm also wondering how correlated Chinese equities, given all the predictions of a bubble there, are to Greece. I mean, people are just waiting for China to pop. Could that be a trigger?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Mike, you know, it's interesting. If you look at actually the equity market correlation this year, it's been a lot lower than normal. And the reason is because FX is now becoming the primary driver of equity returns in a global currency war. The equity markets have gone up, generally speaking, have been associated with very weak currencies, whereas, let's say, for example, Switzerland, which has got the worst performing equity market here today, they've got actually the strongest currency. So I would argue this is why equity correlation is going down. I think China, absolutely, I think until now, China has been sort of trading on its own. Okay, with very low correlation for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, but I think that could very well change. If China really goes down 20-30%, I think everybody's going to wake up to
right.
the reality that this is going to be a big problem for the entire world.
Mike, China equities are correlated to the popularity of Cleveland Cavalier basketball jerseys.
Oh, then they're in big trouble.
Inversely related, I might point out.
Basketball season is over. We can move on. Poor LeBron and the folks in Cleveland.
Yeah.
We'll just say that and move on, right?
Yeah. But, you know, here, I mean, the correlations, the link-ups, how odd is this, Dr. Wu? You've been doing this for years, and I looked at European currency surfaces and all this, you know, CFA physics mumbo-jumbo stuff. Just for the basic listener, is this normal pre-crisis, or is this unusual this time around?
I think it's unusual in the sense that, the realized volatility is very, very low, but the implied volatility is actually very high. So people are afraid to take any positions, and yet people are paying a lot of money to basically buy insurance. And I think, you know, that just tells you the market has lost its plot. I mean, Tom, as you know, the first quarter of this year, most hedge funds had perhaps the best quarter they can remember for 5 years. But the last couple of months have been extremely difficult. A lot of people are getting all their money back. And I think this is telling you a market not only has lost its plot, but also lost its basically capital.
Yeah, it's like reminiscence of the stock operator. Take the month off and keep yourself out of harm's way. We're going to come back with David Wu of Bank of America Merrill Lynch and continue this discussion. The headlines came fast and furious about an hour ago. Mike, I don't even know where to begin with the Greece headlines. They are such a cacophony of emotion within every 10 headlines or go or so. There is, I mean, how trite is this? Ball is now in court of Greek authorities.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do with that?
We're down to cliches here. Sound and fury signifying nothing at the moment. There's no progress. The fact that Tsipras is saying his government is willing to take the responsibility for saying no.
Yeah.
He seems to be preparing his people for something.
Yeah, and to Michael McKee's point, folks, the markets speak and they are calm. Gold is just one of the great measurements of all this. Has gone nowhere. $11.78 the ounce, down all of $3 this morning. That doesn't count. The 2-year yield 0.70%. The 10-year yield 2.33%. This with futures near flat. Futures up 2.
What else is going on around the world? Let's check in with Denise Pellegrini for the latest headlines. Denise?
Thank you, Michael. A college student in Queens has been charged with conspiring to support a terrorist organization and planning to attack New York City landmarks on behalf of Islamic State. The criminal complaint says Munther Amal Saleh felt Al-Qaeda was becoming too moderate and was trying to learn how to build explosives. An investigation is underway into what caused a balcony in Berkeley, California to collapse early yesterday morning, killing 6 people and seriously injuring 7 others, including students from Ireland. And the Democratic National Committee says Donald Trump's entry into the Republican presidential race adds what it calls some much-needed seriousness to the GOP field. That sarcastic statement follows Trump's announcement of his candidacy yesterday. Tom, Mike.
Very good. Denise, thank you so much. EU said to reach initial accord to extend Russia's sanctions, one of the headlines we're getting. Another 6 months. Thank you.
Keep futures, an eye on the ruble here.
Futures up 1. Yeah, the ruble weaker here, 54.04 per dollar. Stay with us. Bloomberg Surveillance with David Wu.
The news update brought to you by Mercedes-Benz of Greenwich, where the relationship is everything, off I-95 in beautiful Greenwich, Connecticut. MercedesBenzofGreenwich.com.
Business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
And I'm Gina Cervetti from Bloomberg World Headquarters, and this is a Bloomberg Radio Business Flash. We're watching FedEx this morning with shares down just over 1% after fourth quarter adjusted earnings per share and revenue trailed estimates. Allergan is buying Kythera Biopharmaceuticals in a deal valued at $2.1 billion. Kythera shares surging this morning 23%. Today we're watching the Federal Reserve, which wraps up a two-day policy meeting followed by a statement and then a press conference with Chair Janet Yellen. And stock index futures now little changed as Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says he's ready to take responsibility for rejecting the terms of a deal on aid if creditors' demands are unacceptable. We check the markets every 15 minutes on Bloomberg. S&P E-mini futures up 1.5%. NASDAQ E-mini futures unchanged. Dow E-mini futures up 22%. And NYMEX crude oil up 1.9% at $61.09 a barrel. Tom and Mike.
Gina, thanks so much. Greatly appreciate it. Bloomberg Surveillance this morning, this Fed Day, brought to you by Invesco. Get to the core of the alternative investing with Invesco's panel of alternatives experts. Watch the conversation at Invesco.com/interactive. That's Invesco.com/interactive. Michael McKee and Tom King with David Wu of Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Dr. Wu, can you see a bubble coming? It's an interesting question. I mean, everybody from Ben Bernanke to, I think, Steve Roach, ex-Morgan Stanley, have talked about it. Can you see a bubble coming?
I see a bubble, and I see that in China. I see, you know, because in some sense, right, if you think about this, right, with 5 years of basically money printing, you know what? In some sense, all this money ended up in China, in Chinese stock market. And I think from that point of view, you know, the leverage that we've been seeing building up, I think this time around, in emerging markets, as mainly in China, that was forced to import very low interest rates from the U.S. as a result of Fed basically QE. So from that point of view, think about 2008, the leverage was in U.S. housing as a result of basically 5 years of easy monetary policy. This time around, after 5 years of easy monetary policy, the bubble is now sitting in China where the leverage is. So I think from that point of view, this is why I think, you know what? Normally when I come into office, the first thing I want to look at is where 10-year Treasury yield is trading at, where your dollar is trading at. These days, the first thing I look at on Bloomberg Terminal is basically where Shanghai Composite is trading at.
4,967.89 today. It was up 1.7%. But overall, how high does it go before we see it pop? How long do they have?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, to some extent, this is, as the nature of a bubble, you have no idea when it's going to basically burst. But it is also true already. If you look at on a market value to EBITDA ratio, this thing is trading almost 30 times versus U.S. only at 12 times versus EM average of 10 times. So this is already, from that point of view, probably the biggest stock market bubble since the IT bubble in 2000.
What's a knock-on effect when that bubble bursts? And in what way? Is it a knock-on effect of Vietnam and South Korea? Or is it a knock-on effect to Topeka, Kansas?
I think it's going to be a knock-on effect on the whole world economy because, remember, the only thing that's holding up the Chinese economy are the Chinese consumers right now. The Chinese consumers are all basically involved in the Chinese stock market. If Chinese stock market really goes down 20-30%, which I think it could very well do once the bubble basically burst, I think, you're going to see a slowdown in Chinese consumption. Chinese growth is going to slow. This is going to be bad news for commodity prices. It's going to be bad news for basically emerging markets. It's going to probably be very deflationary, Tom. And it's probably going to be very bullish for the U.S. dollar and basically very bullish for U.S. treasuries.
Why are the Chinese blowing a bubble? Why are they letting this happen?
My gut feeling, Mike, is that, they're simply running out of levers. So this is why the irony of this is the last 10 years, whenever you go to Beijing, they'll tell you, we learned from the mistake of the Japanese. Will never allow basically a stock market bubble and a real estate bubble to basically happen in China because we know what happens when these bubbles burst. But guess what? The fact that they've got two huge bubbles right now sitting in China in the form of basically the stock market and the real estate bubble, that just tells me in some sense they're much closer to basically the Japan in the late 90s than they have been willing to admit until now.
I suppose before we let you go, we need to talk about the United States.
Yes.
and the Fed, only the biggest economy and biggest central bank in the world. Janet Yellen meets today. They're not going to do anything. What are you looking for her to say or the charts to show that could move market sentiment?
I think what the market wants to hear from her is basically giving strong, essentially, the reasons that the Fed is going to be hiking rates in September. Because the market is now priced in September, with 100% basically probability. So the market needs assurance from the Fed that basically all is well and that they need reasons not to hike basically in September. So if it's anything less than that, I think, you're probably going to see a bit of rally in treasuries and unfortunately at least some softer dollar, I think, in the next 24 hours.
What do you think of the U.S. economy at this point? Does it support the 100% September view?
My personal view is that the strong dollar and the lower capex spending associated with the slump in energy prices definitely are doing their part. But what has surprised me, like everybody else, is the softness of U.S. consumers. I don't understand why is it at the start of the year everybody I know was looking for U.S. consumers to step up, and the fact that they haven't, perhaps the biggest single surprise. And I don't have an explanation.
Well, I saw a chart the other day. I'm sorry, folks, I can't cite it, which is a new lower marginal propensity to consume. And the bottom line is all the dynamics that you and I studied are there, but everybody's going, I think I better save.
Tom, that's exactly it. This is the biggest worst.
Did you see that? I got an exactly it. Does that count, John Tucker?
Yeah, we'll give that to you.
That's exactly it. Okay, thank you.
Because I don't think the Fed has certainly not factored that in the central scenario, which is what if it's possible that the baby boomers are now approaching retirement age, now all of a sudden realizing they haven't saved enough, and at zero interest rates, they're not going to be able to finance their retirement,
right.
And that we're seeing a structural increase in saving rate. That, I think, is possibly the biggest risk, I think, to this whole Fed hiking rates in September and December continue next year and everything else.
And on a $15 trillion nominal, 16, whatever it is, I lose track, folks, I'm showing my age, nominal GDP economy, 100 basis point change in our structural savings rate is a big deal. It's a big deal to Gap stores, just as one example.
It's a huge deal. I think it's a huge deal. Okay. And which tells you that you're going to be growing at 2% rather than 3%. That's going to be a very big difference.
David Wu, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate your efforts for us today on this Fed Day. We're going to continue this discussion. Any number of good guests coming along, particularly Neil Sauce of Credit Suisse, Mike McKee. Neil is someone who, with James Sweeney, have flat out said the deflation fears are overdone. They just mince no words about it.
Well, let's hear what he has to say about the inflation forecast from the Fed today.
This is why we do Bloomberg Surveillance. They have David Wu and Neil Sauce back-to-back. It's pretty special, and we thank our team for arranging their trips here on the Surveillance Gulf Stream. Futures up 2, Dow futures up 26, a 10-year yield 2.32%.
We're cutting you down to the opening bell, brought to you by Open Road Auto Group. Open Road Auto Group offers 17 locations with the best brands and the best prices. Find them all online at openroadautogroup.com. Your experience, your open road.
Broadcasting live to Boston, Bloomberg 1200. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, SiriusXM Channel 119. And to the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130. This is Bloomberg Surveillance.
It's 8:30 on Wall Street. I'm Michael McKee, along with Tom Keene. Economic indicators are brought to you by Commonwealth Financial Network. When it's time to change the conversation, talk with a broker-dealer RIA that's ready to listen. Call 866-462-3638 or visit commonwealth.com to learn more. No economic indicators this morning, but perhaps the biggest economic news of all due this afternoon. 2 p.m., Janet Yellen and her colleagues on the Federal Reserve will release their latest decision on interest rates, their latest summary of economic projections, and their latest dot charts. Then at 2:30, Chair Yellen will hold a press conference. Tom, a lot going on this afternoon, and, of course, you can hear it all here on Bloomberg Radio, 2 p.m. Wall Street time.
Excuse me, I'm going to press the red button as I look at my dot plots.
Dots, what you want
to do. Do you
think
Neil Sauce studied dot plots at university?
There's a class at Williams College in dots, I think.
Dots.
Was that the case, Dr. Sauce? Did you take dots at Williams, or did you do that in your Princeton graduate work?
In those days. You didn't get it on such a pretty screen as we got nowadays.
It is remarkable where we've come, Dr. Sauce. You've been so good for Bloomberg Surveillance and describing ring fence of 8 years ago and all this. Does Janet Yellen have a ring fence around the American economy? Is there a level of confidence at the Fed now that there was when you were there with a younger Paul Volcker?
I think that the link between the U.S. economy and the outside world has been overrated, so to speak, because of the experience in the 1990s when you had the Mexico event in 94 and then the Southeast Asians in 97 and Russia in 98 and so forth. The U.S. is a large continental economy. It's largely closed. Exports only about 12% of the gross product, and a lot of that is exported as intra-company trade, where a company will, make some things here, send them out in long global supply chains to turn them into a finished product, bring them back to sell to American customers. So the idea that the dollar or turbulence or whatever is consequential, it's worth being aware of, but I don't think it's dispositive or decisive. And I think it's also the case that the financial linkages are not really as intense institutionally as they have been. It's not like our banks are overloaded, so to speak, with foreign claimants and so forth.
And Mike, this is a huge deal. Jean-Claude Trichet, among others, talked about this diffusement of information and data, making for less abrupt changes than what we used to experience.
Well, what you say may be true, Neil, but there was still much ado made about the stronger dollar's effect on manufacturing, and it certainly captured the Fed's attention.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that it's absolutely irrelevant, but I don't think it's the central issue from their point of view. If you're sitting at the Fed and at the moment, it strikes me the central issue is that we are approaching what they view as a fully employed labor market. And what are you supposed to do about that? Well, one answer, I think that's self-evident to them anyway, is you may not need to be tight with monetary policy, but you don't need to be at zero. And if zero is an unnecessary degree of economic of financial accommodation, then I think they view it as undesirable.
Well, that's a good point, that it doesn't need to be at zero. What is the proper monetary policy setting for the kind of economic growth we have right now?
Well, that is, of course, the really tricky question. It is true that the labor market has done reasonably well of late. But the bigger issue for the economy, for the society, ultimately for the Fed, is that we've been throwing an awful lot of labor at the problem of production without getting a whole lot of GDP in return. That is to say, productivity has been relatively poor. And you wonder, what role does monetary policy have in improving productivity? Because that is the ultimate source of any improvement in economic well-being.
What role does it have? I'm not aware of it, but help me here. What role does it have?
Well, I mean, in a blackboard sort of way, we teach undergraduates that, you know, a business investment, for example, is sensitive to interest rates. And so if you have a stimulative monetary policy, well, you're going to get more factories and more capital per worker and so forth.
Yeah.
In the real world, it doesn't look nearly that sensitive. But it may be asymmetric. It may be that the business investment is more sensitive to a tightening of policy. That is to say, monetary policy as a restrictive mechanism actually works more efficiently than monetary policy as a stimulus. And that puts you in a frame of mind, and I think the Fed is in that frame of mind for that reason and for others, to say, yeah, zero probably isn't the desired or the necessary level of monetary accommodation. But when we move off that, we're not trying to stop the economy in its tracks. We're going to be relatively gradual in searching out what the right level of interest rates is.
Go ahead, Tom.
No, please.
I was just going to ask where they are in timing. Are they behind the curve? Is this the right time to move, or are they moving early?
Oh, I don't think that if they fulfill the kinds of expectations that I think their rhetoric has been suggesting, that is, okay, we'll do a little something now, but we're going to be very gradual, very data dependent, you know, very softly is the English phrase.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the economy is all that sensitive to the difference between this Fed funds rate and one that's, let's say, 50 or even 75 basis points higher.
Let's come back with Neil Soss of Credit Suisse. Of course, their vice chairman, heading up for years, their research effort, James Sweeney, chief economist for Credit Suisse. And I can't say enough about the value add that they've done on research, really pushing against the deflation hysteria that we witnessed here over the last couple months. The euro, 112.69, very quiet with the various Greece pairs against Germany this morning.
This hour of surveillance is brought to you by Land Rover Mount Kisco. Visit LandRoverMountKisco.com. Now let's check in with Denise Pellegrini, get the latest news headlines. Denise?
Thank you. House and Senate Republican leaders will be holding briefings to try to figure out how to respond as the Supreme Court gets closer to ruling on a portion of President Obama's health care overhaul. It's possible the justices could throw out federal subsidies, and that would leave millions of people unable to afford to pay for their health care plans. It looks like nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran may have to be extended beyond a June 30th deadline. Iran, the U.S., and five other world powers remain far apart on a nuclear deal that would curb Tehran's ability to make atomic weapons in exchange for lifting sanctions. And Donald Trump has only been a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination for a day, but he's already having trouble rocking in the free world. The New York real estate mogul arriving at his campaign kickoff yesterday as the Neil Young song blared through the atrium at Trump Tower in Manhattan. Problem is, guys, Young says he didn't give Trump permission to use the song. And Young says, even though he's a Canadian citizen, Tom and Mike, he is backing Bernie Sanders in the race for president.
Yeah, this happens a lot, is how I would put it.
And Rockin' in the Free World is not exactly a pro-U.S. kind of song.
No, I think
I was going to say.
Probably the Daily News got it right at about Donald Trump, and I'll leave it at that. Let's turn to sports. Here, Rob Buschka. The Bloomberg NBC Sports Report, hockey's over, and now so is professional basketball for the season. Disappointing news for LeBron, but great news for those on 960 AM in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, that's right. Good morning, Mike and Tom. In fact, it was just 24 hours after the NHL season closed out in six. The NBA did the same. Six games in Cleveland.
Jumper's no good. Curry the rebound. It's taken 40 years. But once again, the Bay team is the best team. The Golden State Warriors have won the NBA title.
Warriors radio with the call. Golden State wins its first title since 1975, beating the Cavaliers 105-97. Victory parade is planned in Oakland on Friday. LeBron had 32, 18, and 9 in the loss, and Andre Iguodala was named the finals MVP, first bench player ever to do so. Baseball, former Yankee David Phelps beat New York 12-2 in Miami as Yankee starter Nathan Uvalde gave up 8 runs in 2/3 of an inning. Mets, they beat Toronto again, 3-2 this time. Matt Harvey improved to 7-4. The Mets lead the Nationals by a game and a half. And here's one for you. The FBI is looking into a report. The St. Louis Cardinals hacked into the Houston Astros network, breaching classified player information and obtaining scouting reports and personnel records. And Women's World Cup action north of the border in Canada. Team USA, congrats to them. A big win. They beat Nigeria 1-0 to advance. Meanwhile, that is your NBC Bloomberg Sports Update. Mike, Tom?
Thanks so much. Greatly appreciate that. This headline just out. This is what people have been really waiting for from Federal Express, is an early logistics company across the entire American economy. FedEx sees U.S. economic growth for 2015 at, 2.3%, 2.3% down from a call just above 3% or prior. Futures up 3, Dow futures up 33. From New York City and coast to coast, Bloomberg surveillance.
U.S. bond yields are higher this morning as investors await the Fed. What will the dot plot say about where they go next? We'll continue our conversation with Neil Soss on surveillance.
Business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
And I'm Gina Cervetti from Bloomberg World Headquarters, and this is a Bloomberg Radio Business Flash. U.S. stock index futures are a little changed to higher as investors await the outcome of the Federal Reserve's meeting today for clues on the timing of any interest rate increase, and also amid signs that the impasse in Greek aid talks is deepening. We are watching FedEx, with shares now down 1.5% after fourth quarter results missed estimates. Some deals are making news. Allergan is buying Kythera Biopharma in a deal valued at $2.1 billion. Also, Hill-Rom is buying Welch Allyn for about $2 billion, with that deal merging two healthcare industry manufacturers. We check the markets every 15 minutes on Bloomberg Radio. And those S&P E-mini futures up just about 3 points. Dow E-mini futures up 35. NYMEX crude oil up 1.6% at $60.93 a barrel. Tom and Mike.
Gina, thanks so much. Bloomberg Surveillance this morning brought to you by Invesco. Why to add an active strategy to a passive portfolio? Invesco's diversified dividend team discusses four reasons to consider this approach. Visit Invesco.com/US. Invesco, Invesco.com/US. It is 8:48 on Wall Street.
The following is from Bloomberg View. Opinions and commentary from Bloomberg columnists.
I'm Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Greece and its creditors are both talking tough. It seems as if it's obviously in everyone's best interest to make a deal, and yet it seems as if there is a good chance that a deal will not be made. What's going on? The cold arithmetic of markets is coming into conflict with the emotional tools that humans use to get along in groups. You can point out that the Greek government was wildly overspending, that default will bring more suffering, not less, that the country's inability to collect the taxes it's owed is a big part of its fiscal trouble. Many of these things are true, but emotionally, they're very much beside the point. Humans have a lot of deep-seated instincts about fairness, sharing, and loyalty, which helped us to survive in the small groups we evolved for. We instinctively feel that it's wrong for some to suffer while others enjoy a surplus, and we instinctively care more about the suffering of people like us than those far away. If we didn't, the wealthy industrial nations would have no social programs at all and would instead be sending all their money to poor countries. So when rich creditors start making demands on poorer nations,
those deeper instincts often win out over the obvious and sensible market logic of the international financial community. Nations, like people, can become what behavioral scientists call altruistic punishers. They're willing to cost themselves quite a lot to punish someone or some group they think is being unfair. Cutting off your nose to spite your face may be poor fiscal policy, but it may also be more rational by the logic of human groups. I'm Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more commentary, go to BloombergView.com.
This has been Bloomberg View.
And Bloomberg View columns, it can be heard weekdays, hourly, on Bloomberg Radio. Michael?
We're talking with Neil Suss. He is the chief economist for investment banking at Credit Suisse, the head of their research department. And Neil, the Fed today, Janet Yellen speaks at 2:30. Is there anything of interest that would create some market movement or make the market sit up and take notice that we should pay attention to? Or is she going to try to be as bland as possible?
Oh, I don't expect bland. I expect her to repeat what she's been saying for some time now, which is her expectation that the economy will, in the course of this year, justify the beginnings of some increase in short-term interest rates in the U.S. I expect her to say that, you know, as plainly as she knows how. That's not the same thing as saying we're going to start today. It's not the same thing as saying we're going to start at the July FOMC meeting or the September meeting or any other rather specific guidance, but I do think that the broad outline of monetary policy is being set.
Neil, I'm putting out on Bloomberg Radio Plus an elegant chart, which I know you've got tattooed to your brain, which is five-year forward swap. So you go out 5 years, folks, and then you go out another 5 years and try to guesstimate where we are. All you need to know is in autumn last year, the dialogue changed. Now we're in recovery. When you come out of a deflation or disinflationary reality or scare, do things happen quickly, or do guys like Neil Suss and women like Janet Yellen, do they have time to adapt and adjust and gauge the vector of the recovery in inflation expectations?
I don't think markets these days are capable of taking a leisurely approach to these questions, because there's so little cushion of income in bonds in particular that it's very hard to hold things in the hope and expectation that at least I'll be cash positive because I've got a coupon coming in. So you take illustratively that German Bund that attracted so much attention. It went to 5 basis points. Well, it's a 0.5% coupon. Over its lifetime, all a bond can give you is that income, and there isn't very much of it. So I think you're going to get very herky-jerky responses in markets, very abrupt moves from one level to another. And that's a problem for the monetary authorities, because they've got a financial stability mandate to boot. So it's not just about helping the economy do what it's supposed to do. It's about doing that in a way that for sure avoids a new financial crisis and preferably creates as stable a financial system as possible for time.
Well, within that imperative, are they at risk from a lot of external events, things they can't control that could lead them to lose control at least of the long end of the markets, if not monetary policy overall?
Oh, I think so. I think in particular the very short end, in the U.S. at least, is very much being priced because of the new regulatory regime that encourages the holding of Treasury bills. And the long end, as your question implies, has partly at least a resonance with the German and Japanese and other international yields, but it's also a reflection of the extension of life at old age, which means pension plans, insurance companies, and so forth need to own longer-dated securities. So the Fed is going to be operating, I suspect, on Fed funds rate and so forth, but the main pressure of that will be borne in the 3, 5, 7 year maturities in the yield curve.
It's just fascinating. We're in, Dr. Suss, we've got to get, you know, within our Fed discussion here, the amazing flow that we see on Greece. I saw some Credit Suisse headlines yesterday that I thought were just brilliant about almost the cacophony of the headlines we see. Is there any economics to our analysis now, or is Greece just become a political stew?
Oh, I think it is largely political. I'm not a world's living expert, but my understanding is that the bargaining daylight, so to speak, between the budgetary demands on the two sides is relatively small. So that suggests there's a political dimension to this. But I think the broader point, and this is comes right back to the issue of how the monetary authorities assure financial stability, is that you never really can know in advance all the vectors of contagion if something's going to go wrong. So people talk about, you know, a Greek exit, or they talk about capital controls or whatever. And that all, in a sense, because you can put it in words, makes it seem a little more predictable and orderly. But you can't be certain of that. You know, in the aftermath of Lehman, it wasn't completely obvious what dominoes would fall. And we now know a lot more about those dominoes. But we don't know. Well, I certainly don't feel comfortable saying we know everything that would flow from some kind of disruption in the Greek situation. That is itself a very strong incentive for making a deal.
Well, it doesn't look like there is a lot of incentives, or at least incentives aren't working at the moment from the rhetoric that we're hearing. Mm. If you had to, and you probably do, there'd be probably people at Credit Suisse who are calling you up and saying what dominoes are going to fall, what would you predict would be the biggest problem?
Well, I think the one thing that's sort of most common in a crisis element is that markets become they seize up. You just simply get a disengagement, get less activity, and that's particularly true as you move away from the things that are sort of flight to quality instruments. Now, so far, what's interesting, I would say, is that there's been really very little flight to quality, considering the volume of the headlines.
Yeah.
And that's suggestive that there's a kind of complacency. But I think on the other side of that, it's also the case that you probably are observing a little less activity, volume, and so forth, and you're probably observing cash building inside of portfolios as a precaution against that sort of problem.
Neil Suss, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. With Credit Suisse, their vice chairman of research. Michael McKee, I what a great hour. I mean, David Wu and Neil Suss back-to-back with – I think Dr. Suss with a more optimistic projection than some of the tumult we saw from David Wu. David just back, I should point out, from Asia. He told me, Michael, that he was really thunderstruck by the size of a slowdown nation to nation.
Yeah.
Within Asia. Well,
everybody should be prepared now for 2:00.
Yeah. And give us a review. You're going to be here at 1:55.
Yep.
Do you get an embargoed set of stuff, or do you go in blind?
We go in blind.
So you go in.
I think it's safe to say I can right now give you the headline at 2:00. Fed does not move interest rates.
Oh, okay, thank you. And then from there, would you like to give us some headlines on the dot plots?
Dot plots issued.
We'll talk seriously. We'll talk a little bit about that. What will Mr. McKee actually see when they release the dot plots? Futures up 3. It is Fed Day. You get another hour of Bloomberg Surveillance. Good morning.